Before I introduce this week's guest, a quick content warning. This episode includes stories of emotional abuse and manipulation. If you are experiencing this or something similar, I've linked support resources in the show notes. Julie Barth had already survived the unthinkable. She lost her husband to stage 4 pancreatic cancer, and he left her behind with 4 small children. While she was still in the thick of her grieving process, she met another man. Unfortunately, this man was not a good man. He lied to her. He manipulated her. He stalked her. He emotionally abused her, and he threatened to kill her. It breaks my heart every time I hear a story like this, but I am so grateful for these brave women who come forth and share their stories because I know that it helps other women out there who have either been through the same thing or who are still going through the same thing today. Julie's contact info is in the show notes if there are any of you who need advice or help in the situations that you're currently in. I personally feel, and tell me what you think as you have more of these conversations and talk about your life, I feel like it's like so cathartic. I feel like every time, even when it's not me telling my story, I learn something from my guest or I hear something and I'm like, oh, that makes me feel better. So it's so nice to have these moments. And I'm just like, how grateful can I possibly be for all these beautiful people that are sharing their lives with me?
Yes, so. I agree. I do. And the kindness of people have been, like the people that have interviewed me, you know, they're just so,
Yeah, it's wonderful. Well, Julie, welcome to the Scarlet Edit. I'm so happy to have you here.
Hi, Nikki. Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So we had got to talking about narcissistic relationships, and you have a very different story than some of the other stories I've shared so far on this show about being with someone who is a narcissist. And I thought that because you have so many children and they were involved in your whole journey with this man, that it would be really valuable for my audience to hear what you went through and how you got through it and what you learned. So firstly, I just want to thank you for coming on to share.
Well, thank you for having me. Thank you for telling my story and hopefully helping other people.
Yeah, definitely. So where do you want to start?
Well, I suppose that my backstory is probably a good place to start, only because I think that that is why I ended up in the situation I was in. I was married to my grammar school sweetheart. Like, he was my first kiss, and we met in third grade, and we kind of lost touch, but then met back up again in our 20s. And from that moment on, it was like, where have you been? You know, I kind of felt like I had found something a piece that was really missing in my life. And so we proceeded to have our first child and then our second child. We had a whole bunch of issues with. She's special needs, but it was just a catastrophe for like 4 years of, you know, trying to get her to live. And so 4 years of that, and then right as I had 2 more children, so we had a total of 4, and right as she was getting better, we found out that he had stage 4 pancreatic cancer.
Oh, no.
Yeah. So we had, our youngest was 6 months, our oldest was 10. So, you know, I basically was told he has 2 weeks to live, go home, let him say goodbye to his kids. And fortunately, or unfortunately in some ways, he lived for 16 months. And so there were some really, really terrible, you know, months. So after he passed, you know, I had these 4 kids looking to me, and I had been stuck in, you know, the 4 years with my daughter Tatum and traveling and then his illness. And so I think that I was just ripe to want to ditch my life. You know, it was like, I don't want to be me anymore. I don't want to deal with what I'm dealing with. I felt almost as if I had lost, you know, a lot of my adulthood. And so the person that I met was working in my house, and he was 10 years younger, and he was very unencumbered, I guess is the best way to say it. He didn't care what people thought. He would just say what he meant. And he was really good at like kind of pushing buttons. But at the time, I just felt like there was a way that I was supposed to behave and a way that I wasn't. And I felt so pigeonholed by so many people in our community that I was like, you mean you can do whatever you want, not feel bad about it? You mean you can say no to people? You mean you can just be you? And So I'm not sure if I would have been attracted at any other time in my life to somebody like that. But at that moment, it was exactly what I needed and what I thought I wanted. So I'd always wanted a big family. And because she was very detached and she really didn't like my children, which looking back at it right now, I had my life with him. And then I had my life with my children, and I tried not to crisscross them when we first met, you know. But I guess I wanted more children, so I ended up, we had IVF and decided to move away from where we were at. And I just felt like I was going to start over. And so that's kind of what led me into the scenario that I was in with him.
Okay. Was it the desire to start over that made you choose to move, or were there other kind of determining factors that you guys thought would be the best to begin your life somewhere fresh?
I think that, you know, the whole community knew me. So like when they would see me, like people would be sad because anywhere I went, it was like, I would remind them that Colin was no longer here. That was my first husband. And I also felt like, you know, this is going to sound judgmental, but it's not meant to be. Everyone in the community had, you know, given us money. They had had fundraisers. And I think that sometimes when tragedy hits somebody and there's no reason why, I think sometimes it makes people feel like super vulnerable and like it could happen to them. So sometimes I think they try and make up reasons why things happen to you. So I almost felt like, you know, people felt like I wasn't grieving enough or I didn't care. And here I was moving on. And, you know, it wasn't that. It was just that I couldn't sit in it any longer because just when other people started grieving, like I had lost like a piece of him every day for 16 months. And so I wanted to have other children. I just wanted to put it in my past. And my ex-husband was more than happy to pick up and leave. You know, that was a fantastic idea to him. He didn't really want to be a dad. He didn't really want to be involved in my life. And he never really asked me how I was doing or how I was feeling, which at that time I was like, good, because I don't want to talk about it. And everyone else was trying to like make me slow down, process, you know, grieve. And I was like, nope, nope, nope. So what I thought at the start was that he was like giving me space and, you know, giving me time to breathe. Well, when we moved, I recognized that it wasn't about trying to give me space. He really just didn't care about me or about how I was feeling. And, you know, was just happy enough for me not to talk at all, really.
That's got to be such a fascinating hindsight revelation to realize that the person you were with, like, didn't really give a shit about you.
Yeah. Well,
like, does it make you think, like, why was he even with me?
No, I know why he was with me. He enjoyed being the good guy. He enjoyed because people did know who I was and people did look up to me at first. He enjoyed kind of latching on to that. He wanted to give people the impression that he was saving this poor widow with four kids. Like that was very alluring to him. Like, look at me, I'm stepping in and I'm saving the, you know, poor Julie and her kids. And it just went from there, you know, because then it turned into I was crazy. And, you know, I was abusing him and I took those young days and just that was exactly the scenario that he wanted in all of it, that, you know, he was the savior and I was the crazy one, which, you know, he was coming off of, he had just broken up with his fiance and, you know, talking about how crazy she was and she was a drug addict. And I'm listening to him thinking, wow, that woman has got to have couple screws loose. And then, you know, all those years looking back at it, I'm like, oh, I can only imagine what people thought of me. Because if she was a drug addict, it was probably because she couldn't stand to be with him, honestly. I mean, that's how bad it was to be with him.
Well, like the savior victim complex has got to just be so bizarre to deal with.
It is, because the whole time it's like he was the one beating all of us down. He was the one that was destroying our lives while at the same time he was telling everyone he was saving all of us. So we moved pretty far from where we were at. I left my whole family behind. I left my friends behind. And he was more than happy to tell me that everyone hated me. You know, everybody, he used to tell me nobody likes you. And I was like, what do you mean? Like, why doesn't anyone like me? And he'd be like, it's just you. I can't tell you why. People just don't like you. Oh, and it was terrible because I am a people pleaser by nature. And the thought of someone not liking me at that time, now I think I really don't care that much anymore. But, you know, coming off of feeling like everyone was judging me for, you know, moving on so quickly after Colin died or for whatever reason, him telling me everybody hates you, or he'd make up things like he told me that Colin's mom, you know, had pulled him aside and said like, well, I understand what's in it for Julie, but what's in it for you getting into this relationship, where I really couldn't ever see her saying that. But, you know, it was just the reality that he was painting for me. Was just like, I don't know, like looking back on it now, it all makes sense. But when I was stuck in it, I was just like, and I thought, did I really, like, am I broken? Did my experience with Colin and my experience with Tatum and all of the, you know, grief, and did it break me? Like, am I crazy? Started acting ways that I had never seen myself behave ever, you know, just crazy things.
Well, that is something to touch on. Absolutely. But I want to just go back to what you were saying about grief. And, you know, more and more lately, I feel like we see people judging people for how they grieve. And it's such a horrible thing to judge somebody for, because I know with every ounce of my soul that no matter what my brain may tell me about a situation that I have not yet been through, that I will never know how I will actually react in a situation until I'm going through it myself. So it's just so easy for all these keyboard warriors to make comments or for people to gossip and say this, that, or the other about how somebody is grieving when they've never been through that situation themselves.
Yeah. And, you know, it's funny because I'm like a documentary junkie, which, by the way, it's always the husband, just so you know. but I was watching one the other day, and like they were on trial, and there was a coach that like sat this guy down and was like coaching him about what kind of facial expressions he should have and how he should react. And, you know, it was like he was saying, people are going to judge you as guilty if you react this way, or if you cry, or if you don't cry, if you know, and I'm watching it just fascinated that, you know, there's a right and a wrong way in everyone else's head. But when we get there, you know, we just, you know, it's your experiences is how you feel, and whatever's going on externally has nothing usually to do with what's going on in the inside. Because I had four little kids, and they had watched their dad die. So when he passed, like I couldn't carry on with this, oh my gosh, every day. It was just too heavy for everyone.
Yeah.
So I'm sure from the outside, it looked like I was like, well, we're all done with that, you know, but that's kind of what I had to do to survive. So yeah, it was hard feeling as if everyone thought that I somehow didn't love him enough, or I was just replacing him, or whatever, you know, people thought, or what I thought they thought. Because sometimes, you know, what you think people are thinking is even worse than what they actually are. But you know.
I mean, our minds.
And that's what you play. And that's
make
what you play
us crazy.
Off of.
Yes, definitely.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's such a interesting thing because it's like we sit there and we think like, oh my God, all these people must think this about me or must think that about me. And at the end of the day, when you finally get to a point, I feel like later, and this definitely comes later in life, you realize that like they're not even thinking about you at all. And so it's like just our brains that are making all this up, right? And they're just like, okay, I'm living my life. Like, see ya.
Right. And like every one of your days is like, oh, I wonder. And they haven't thought about me probably in 10 years, you know, but there's still that like, oh, like as if they care what I'm up to or what I'm doing, you know?
Yeah.
But you do. Like I used to worry so much about it. And you're right. Like they had moved on to the next tragedy or the next, you know, and I'm sure that they were probably like, well, I wish her well, you know, they didn't give it two more thoughts, but it sat in me. And, you know, it was my own guilt. It was my own perception. It was, you know, probably me judging me more harshly than anyone ever could have. But he also sensed that. So in sensing that, he was more than happy to take it and just run with it and beat me over the head with it. And that's how he was able to keep me in line, you know, is to say, you're crazy and I'm going to leave you. Because that was my other thing is, because I had lost Colin, I was so afraid to lose anything more that I probably would have done anything to keep that relationship together, just because, you know, I don't know that I was as in love with him as I thought, but I was in love with the thought of him and how he was my new Colin and he was going to save me and replace, you know, when all he really did was sabotage everything in my, you know, when we moved, he didn't want neighbors. He had to pick a house that was in the middle of nowhere. He kept going home and telling everyone that I was crazy and, you know, it just set me up. You know, you watch these, again, documentaries. Maybe that's why I love them so much, because they're familiar. But, you know, I watch them and I'm like, oh, yeah, yeah, I know it. I know what the plan is here. I can see it coming. But when you're in it, you know, you can't see your way out of it. And you trust that person in your life because, you know, that they're supposed to love you. So you think that they would never do anything behind your back or, you know, but
oh my gosh. And you know, you mentioned that you got to a point where you were like doing things that you will now define as crazy. And I know that I have had moments like that in my own relationship history where I'm acting a certain way and I'm like, who is this person? Like, this is not me. And so I think, you know, it's so important to pay attention to what behavior and even the way we speak to another person, what another person brings out of us. Cause I'm like, I look back on some things and I'm like, I'm not a person that talks like that. I'm not a person that does those things. Like, what was going on? And it was just like, this person was bringing out the worst in me instead of bringing out the best in me. And that's 100%. A huge red flag. Yeah,
it is. Yeah. And if they're bringing out the worst in you, not only are they bringing out the worst in you, and it's not good for you, they're bringing out the worst so that they can beat you over the head with it. You know, he enjoyed when I reacted. He enjoyed making me crazy, because then he was like, see, you're crazy. And that's how they keep you stuck, is because, you know, they tell you you're the problem and then you react and you become the problem. So you believe it. And so it's just this cycle of, I am crazy. He's telling me I'm crazy and I'm acting crazy. So, and again, like you said, like I was in the midst of doing things, being in the back of my head thinking, why are you doing this? Like, let it go. Mm-hmm. Why do you keep picking up your phone? Why do you keep texting? Why are you, you know, telling him to leave, then begging him back? Like, what's the end game here? And I, you know, to this day, I you just becomes, it's almost like an argument. Like when you lose the whole reason you were arguing to begin with, you're just in it to argue, you know, like you don't even know why or what the end game is or how you even win anymore. You're just in it for the argument. So I think that's what our relationship came, is just being in it to argue, which I run from anyone who like brings out anything but the best in me. I'm like, I don't need that in my life anymore. But.
Oh my God. Absolutely. So you did go on though to have two more kids with him, correct?
I did. Yes.
So tell me about that part of the story.
Yeah. So when we left, so we picked up, like I said, and we moved to an entirely different town up on this mountain. And I lost all of my, you know, friends, my family. And I had a lot of support. You know, obviously I had four kids running around. Tatum, who's special needs, still had all kinds of stuff. Well, when we got to North Carolina, which is where we moved, I had my daughter. And then our first daughter, and then Tatum came down with cancer. So we're stuck.
Jesus.
Yeah. So I have nobody to help out. And Tatum has this rare connective tissue cancer. So she had to have like her right side removed and her legs grafted. And it was just this, you know, really long drawn out of everything, you know, to be back in that situation again. And that's really when I started seeing that he was just not there at all. You know, he was irritated by the surgeries. He wouldn't help out with the kids. He was taking jobs out of town so that I was all by myself. And it's funny because after I say that, you know, there was a lot of fighting between the two of us. And I thought at that point, after Tatum got a little bit better, I wanted to go back home. You know, I was like, I miss my family. I miss my home, because I lived in Chicago my entire life. And that's when he proceeded like, oh, you don't have a family. Nobody wants you there. Nobody likes you. You can't go home. And I had dropped the ball with all of my friends, you know, because when I left, I just needed to shut down, you know, and it wasn't them. It wasn't really me. I just like couldn't handle a lot of my life. So I just thought, if I just leave it in my past, but so that was the point when he was like, oh, well, we should move further south near my parents, which again, this is where you eye roll because it sounded great, you know, at the time. But so that's when I decided to have one more child, and we ended up moving closer to his parents. And that's really when everything just completely fell apart.
Oh, okay. Because when you said that, I was thinking to myself, like, why would he want to be closer to his family if he wanted, like, all of this isolation? So I guess it's just more he wanted you away from any of your support system.
Yes. Yes. And in moving close to his parents, because he had already told his parents that I was crazy. He painted me as this, you know, insane woman he was telling them that I was, if he worked, he never gave me a dime for anything, like ever. But he was telling his mom that I was off vacationing and stealing all of his money. We got married.
When would you have time to be off vacationing with all of these children
to take care
of? Well, I did
vacation. But I paid for it. Yeah.
Oh my gosh. It just seems like what a bizarre story. If he's not wanting to participate with taking care of the kids and he's not giving you any money, like what a fantasy land he's making up that you're just off gallivanting the world doing whatever you want.
Yeah. And spending up all of his money. Just like spending all of his cash, which I never saw whatsoever. But this is the painting. This is the picture that he was painting of me to his friends, because he had friends here where I live now. His mom and dad were here. And the whole time he's running back to Chicago and telling, because we knew the same people. He was telling everyone in Chicago that I was insane and crazy and abusing him. He was sending out my text messages and chains to his friends. I didn't recognize that he was videotaping me and, again, showing it to everybody back home. I mean, it was like we got married in Florida. I decided, because Tatum was sick, and it just made sense to have like a destination wedding just to go away for a weekend. So we had all of our friends meet us, and his parents were there. And his parents, which I didn't know at the time, gave him like $10,000 to help pay for the vacation venue. He never told me. He pocketed all the money. I paid for all of it. So here I am, not even saying thank you to his parents for giving us $10,000, because I didn't know, because
didn't
he
know.
Pocketed. I didn't even know.
Oh,
so as
no.
much as
so
I want to say
like,
that is. Yeah. They're
yeah,
like, oh,
they're
there
probably
she
like,
goes stealing money again.
Yeah. Yep. Oh my God.
Yeah. And I didn't find that out probably until after we were divorced. But that was the kind of thing that he did. He would. You know, he would say one thing to me and then just, it was a smear campaign from day one. I mean, you know, and again, it makes me think about how he told me that his ex-girlfriend was a drug addict and an alcoholic. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it makes me feel sorry for her. Let's just put it that way. But yeah, so he was very good at what he did, though. I mean, very, very good. And so...
I've always been fascinated by human behavior just in general, but I always have been surprised at how not skeptical some people are when they start dating someone. And then, you know, it's immediate like, oh, well, my ex is insane. My ex is crazy. My ex did this, that, and the other. And it's like, okay, but did she, you know, is this all like, what level of truth is here? And what role did you play in this? Because that relationships take two. And I've always found it surprising when I have, you know, seen some very intelligent women who are just, you know, oh, yeah, his ex is nuts. And you're just like, OK. And so then you're like, you're saying, you're like, OK, I was believing all this. And now on the back end, I'm like, oh, my God, that poor woman.
Yeah. And you know, that was it's funny because my first husband, who I grew up with, like he you know, I knew him throughout high school. I had heard stories of college, you know, and he came to me when we first started dating and he said to me, all of my exes were crazy. And my answer to him was, were they crazy when you met them? Because that is how, if somebody comes to you and they're like, my ex is crazy, you take them at face value, like, oh, well, but I'm going to think twice. And especially if someone says like a couple of my exes were crazy, it should make you kind of pause and say like, okay. People don't get along and I get that. But usually if a guy says a woman is crazy, not that I haven't ever met crazy women, but, you would think that they would have a little bit more class than to, tell all of their dirty laundry to you about their ex.
Absolutely. And when they're saying it about multiple, it's like, well, the common denominator is you, babe. So,
either you're a really bad judge of character, in which case I don't know why you're picking me, or, either you're saying that you pick poorly, which doesn't reflect well on me, or
Oh my gosh. So you're down there. So then you have more kids and you're down living near his parents. And you said that that's where things started falling apart.
I mean, they were already bad to begin with, but it was like the more that, where at first it was like, he wasn't helping anything. Every time I tried to like pull away and create like a life for myself, or, I started a company and was doing okay. It wasn't even that he wasn't helping. It's like he started sabotaging me, like if I had any successes or if I had, like he would make sure to downplay them, or, things that I didn't know he was doing came out after we divorced. Like he was setting up chairs around my house. He would tell me that he was leaving and I would just fall apart, and I would sit on my front porch and I would cry because, the thought of being on my own, which I already was so terrifying to me because I had, moved across state, left my family, left my friends. And after he left, I recognized that there was a chair that was like just behind a tree that I had cut down. And he was setting chairs up all around the yard and was telling me that he was leaving. And then he would sit and he would watch me as I was falling apart on the porch or wherever it was that I would be looking for him, thinking, where is he? And I would panic. So I would be like either crying or running around looking for him. And, it's just stuff like that where I thought he was a narcissist to begin with, which I'm sure he is, but it was sociopathic because he derived so much like pleasure from watching me melt down. I mean,
That's diabolical. Yeah. Oh my God.
It really is. Yeah. I mean, I don't know if you've heard of that. There's that Dirty John series on Netflix.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Like, I think I could be right there. I mean, the extent and the level of things, and I'm still finding stuff out, So what happened was after we moved here, he started taking jobs out of town, which I was like, at the time I was upset about it because we would fight a lot about him not being here, which now on the back end, thank God he wasn't. But he was taking jobs out of town. And so I was raising all these kids by myself. And finally, we got separated one time. I was finally like back to myself and I was running again because I'm a runner, but I wasn't able to run. Like I couldn't breathe half the time. And right as I was gaining my speed and feeling better, he came back and he was like, well, okay, if you're going to beg me back. And, it was like, I knew at that moment, like, don't take him back, but I felt sorry for him. So I took him back into the house. And about 6 months after that, my son, who's my second youngest son, came to me and he said, I don't understand why you keep letting him back. Like, he's threatened to kill me. He's threatened to kill you, because he would hear us fighting. And he actually did threaten to kill both of us. And in that moment, I was like, if I can't get out of this because I care enough about me, like I have to get out. My kids deserve better. So that was kind of the beginning of the true end. Mm-hmm. And I had given him, we had drawn up papers from our first separation. So he had the papers in hand and, he kept saying, oh, I don't want, because it was my house. I paid for everything I bought, and he kept saying, well, I don't want anything. It's all yours anyway, and I'm going to sign those papers. I'm going to go on with my life. You go on with your life. And in the state of South Carolina, you need an entire year to be separated before you can file for divorce. And during that year, You are not allowed to see anyone, go out with anyone. It's considered adultery within that year, right?
Whoa.
Yeah, but he had said he was moving on. And I knew he was cheating on me the entire time we were together. And he kept saying, I'm going to sign that paperwork and we're just going to be done. And, you know, of course, hindsight, I should have known better, but I took him at his word.
I was wondering when you said he kept going, like taking work out of town. I was thinking like, oh, I bet he's got girlfriends scattered wherever he's working.
100%. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I caught him on Bumble. Like, it was very obvious toward the end. You know, I'm sure he did it the entire time, but I finally like came to my senses toward the end. But so he had the papers and he, you know, since he was seeing other people, he said he didn't want anything. I started seeing someone. He came back and he sued me for adultery, said I was a drug addict. I was an alcoholic.
I've heard this story before.
Right. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. But the courts hadn't. So he had been setting me up. Yeah. He said he used to call the police to our house. Because nowadays, you know, you don't have landlines anymore.
Yeah.
So if you call the police, then they don't know who made the call. They just know the call is at the residence. So he was telling everyone that I was crazy and calling the police all the time and like accusing him of stuff. And I wasn't, but he was calling the police and saying, and then the police would show up and I was like, why are the police here? Well, I found out later why, because he was trying to paint me as crazy and he was calling the police. So there were... When we finally went for divorce, his parents were calling the police on me and saying I was stalking them. His mother said that I hacked into her email account, which I was I was like, I can't even hack into my own email account. Like,
don't give me that much credit. Oh my God.
Seriously, like I can't even like figure out the door code to my house. And, you know, just like saying I was stalking them and all this craziness. And I had tried to move on. Like I wanted an amicable, I was like, if we're going to be done, let's just go our separate ways and be kind. And, you know, and then he was telling everyone that I was alienating his children and that I was keeping his kids from me. So he sued me to see them, but he never really lost rights to them. The whole thing was insane. And it cost me a whole bunch of money to fight him for nothing. And then I ended up having to pay him off from my house to go away. So the court system is broken for sure. But the good news is I have sole custody and he can't see them. So the truth comes out, but you just spend a fortune getting that truth to come out.
God, that is so insane. I can't believe that you have to be separated for an entire year. It's just the juxtaposition of that where there are, I know that there are some other states. I think Oregon is one where you can almost get a divorce within like 2 weeks or something. It's like,
as it
boom.
Should be, you know, if you're ready and you've gotten to that point, like nobody is just like, I think I'm getting divorced today, you know, like,
right.
I mean, and if they are, then they should get divorced because they were never committed to begin with. But it's like, you know, I don't know what the thought process, we're in the Bible Belt. So I'm sure, you know, it's like, are you sure you want to do this? But really all it does is create this animosity and create situations and scenarios for abusers to continue to abuse, because then they economically abuse you, they financially abuse you, they keep you stuck, you know, it's terrible. And your financial resources are judged as joint during that time, but you're not joint. So you can't get served. It's ridiculous, which is why I opened up the charity I did. But it was, again, you know, when I hear myself tell the story, and this is why I tell the story, because if I watched myself and heard my story as a human being, I would be like, how could you not see that coming? That was really dumb. You know, like, so you weren't getting along. You decided to have another child. Oh, so you moved all the way, you know, I'm sure people's eyes are like, but that is not me. So if you knew me and you knew the backstory of, you know, me caregiving my husband and traveling around with my daughter and saving her. And then I go from that person, really strong, really independent, you know, saving lives, to this person who is diminished to like a shell. I was a shell. I thought I had fibromyalgia because I couldn't breathe, couldn't get out of bed. It was terrible. And I don't, again, you know, I'd like to believe that I wouldn't have fallen for it, but I might have, because these people are so good at what they do. I mean, it truly is masterful.
I mean, so many of the things that you said, though, were so just eye-opening as you were telling the story, right? I mean, you were grieving the loss of someone that you had known since third grade, the father of four of your children. You had to like watch, I can't even imagine what you had to go through during the last 16 months of his life. So you have all of that, then you have four children to take care of and carrying that grief. And you're absolutely right. It's like you can't sit there and be a puddle on the floor every single day when you have four other people that are relying on you. And you have to like start to bring some sense of light back into life because, yes, it's sad, but you can't change death. And for somebody to come along and to just take so much advantage of someone in that state who's literally in survival mode.
Yeah.
And unfortunately,
and to make themselves the savior, you know,
right.
I think that was what really got me was like, again, if you don't want to contribute, that's fine. But it was the sabotage, the constant sabotage of my character, of my home, mm-hmm. of my finances. I mean, in the satisfaction of seeing me in ruins. Like, I don't understand what anyone could possibly do to another human being that would make them want to diminish them and destroy them. And it just, my mind still can't make sense of it. I don't know that anyone's, you know, many therapists telling me, you know, like, you can't make sense of it because your brain doesn't work that way.
Right.
But the level of, you know, when we got divorced because I was paying for everything and I didn't have any savings, when we were together, he bought me an engagement ring and he convinced me that my son stole it. And so I made a police report and I got money from the insurance company. It was like $14,000. So I get the check and it was when we were kind of like, we were struggling because he never worked and my savings were coming, you know, to an end. So I got the check and I was like, oh, thank God I can pay off some bills. Well, this was like 6 years into our marriage and he came to me and he was like, I can't believe that you're going to do that. And I'm like, what? And he's like, I bought you that ring and it meant something to me. You mean you're not going to have it replaced? Like you're just going to like take them in. So I felt like, oh my gosh, he really loves me. And I thought it was like endearing. So I signed the check over to him because he's like, I'm going to have the same ring made. And it was stuff like that where I was like, see, he really does love me. When we went to get divorced, again, I had no money. So I took the engagement ring and I was going to sell it. So I was like, what do I need this for? To buy Christmas gifts for the kids. He had a fake one made for $100.
Oh, I knew that was cool. When you started saying that you went to go sell it, I'm like, oh no, it's not real. It's not real.
Oh, not only is it not real, it was like a piece of glass. Like, yeah. So he stole the first one and sold it. Then he stole the check and stole that money and had a fake one made for me. So, yeah.
Oh my God.
It's just stuff like that where, yeah. The
I mean,
level.
In retrospect, do you want to just like go back and give yourself a hug and just be like, you didn't deserve this? And, you
no,
know,
I want to slap myself and be like, what are you thinking?
I mean, that too,
don't have
right?
another child with him. Yeah. Like, what are you thinking? Yeah. I mean, surely another child will make it all better. Like, how many times? Yeah. But yes, I mean, both. You know, I it's taken me a long time to laugh about it and to see why I did what I did. But again, that's why I tell my story, because it is unbelievable. I hear myself and I'm like, ugh, shaking my head. Like, how could you not see all that coming? But when you're in it, you don't see it. You just, you're so focused on, because narcissists have a way of altering your reality. Mm-hmm. And it's like, if I looked outside, I see the sky is blue. And I say, mm-hmm. the sky is blue. He would say, it's purple. And he would say it over and over and over again until I would be like, maybe I'm wrong. And, you know, that's what they do. They just keep telling you the same thing over and over, whether it's your experience or not, because your brain can't reconcile the disparity between the two of you. You tend to just go, oh, well, maybe I misunderstood it. And the more you say like, oh, maybe I'm just misunderstanding it, the more you start going, gosh, I'm really wrong about a lot of stuff here. Like maybe there's something wrong with me, because if his story is here and mine is here and you're a good person and you want to do the right thing and save things, and you've got to say, well, maybe I am the problem. Maybe the sky is purple and I'm just misinterpreting it. And that's how they get you to do what they want you to do.
Gosh, it's fascinatingly tragic that there are people like that.
Yeah, it is. And I don't know, you know, that's another thing that I really ponder about is like, do they know the master plan? You know, like I always wonder, like, did he get with me and be like, I'm going to ride this all the way to the end. I'm going to destroy or or was it like, did he have good intentions and go bad? Or, you know, like, I would hate to think that he orchestrated it all from the get-go. And that's a pretty big orchestration. But I think that they don't have any empathy, so they don't really care how you feel because it doesn't affect them. And so they're going to use you to get what they want because the only thing that matters is what they want. So I think that they just become very good at manipulating and sensing people because he was so smart. I mean, I don't like to say positive things about him, but he was a very, very, very bright person. He had, and it's sad because he had many talents. Like there's not a thing that I don't think he could have done for good instead of evil, but he used all of his tools on evil. So.
Wow. And as you were going through this, did you have any guilt or any anger like towards Colin? And what I mean by that is like, did you have any guilt that you're in this situation and he's watching down on you or whatever your belief system is, or that he's sitting there being like, Julie, like, what the fuck are you doing? Or on the flip side, did you have any anger towards him? Like, why did you have to leave? Because now I'm in this shit.
I don't think I ever had any anger toward him. You know, after watching someone suffer and as hard as he fought, like that was never a thing. But I will say that there were so many times along the way that I thought, I wish it was me. Because if I had passed and he was here, he would have done so much better for our kids. And, you know, there was a point where I was playing interference and I thought, well, if I just keep them separate and I take the brunt of it. And I thought I was protecting them, you know, like, well, they can't hear it because we fight at night, or I'm text fighting, so they don't understand it. And then I would just like dance with my kids. And, you know, the vacation part was really because I just had to escape my life. So I would take them to the beach all the time. We're only 2 hours from the beach. So my sister had a vacation home. So yeah, I was vacationing. I wasn't paying for it, but I would do anything to get out of here.
Yeah.
And, you know, I try not to think in those terms, but yeah, I mean, I felt like a big failure letting him down. I think that too was what kept me as like, I made this decision. I've got to make the best of it because I'm sold in it. I've committed to it. I want to make this family work. And I wanted to see the same qualities in my second husband as I did in Colin. So I glossed over all the really horrible things and just wanted to make him the new Colin, which he was, with the exception of the height, is about the only thing that they had in common. They were both tall.
Yeah.
I try not to, and that's another reason why I do what I do, because I try not to beat myself up. You know, I've gotten to a place, hopefully, and I teeter back and forth, but, you know, people like this, they don't come along and they don't say, like, I'm going to treat your children horribly. I'm going to bottom you out. I'm going to make you be someone you're not. And if you go into a situation with the best of intentions, like you can't see things like this coming.
Sure.
And in the other respect, like survivor's guilt, like I didn't really understand the whole concept of it because I thought like survivor's guilt was about, you know, boat crashes and like one person makes it, the other person didn't. And I never really understood that when you are a caregiver, you know, I had 16 months, first of all, watching him pass away, which was difficult enough. But so many times I lied to him, you know, like because his faculties had gone to his brain and he'd say like, are we going to chemo? And I'd be like, yep. And, you know, lying to him, not spending as much time as I wanted to because I was constantly like with one or the other. And I think I came out of the situation really like beating myself up because when someone believes that you can save them, you start believing it too, even though it's not true. So, you know, I think that when he started treating me really poorly, I felt as if I deserved it. It almost felt like, it felt like almost like redemption. Like I deserved what I got. And if I could turn that situation around, then I could redeem and prove that I wasn't a bad person, because everything he was saying about me, I was already feeling about myself. So, you know, it just made sense to me, like, well, yeah, I am crazy. Well, yeah, I did make poor decisions. I'd moved my kids away from home, you know, so
yeah.
Again, I think would I have done it without the first situation? I don't know. But it does make sense that I went headlong into it. I mean, mm-hmm. I really jumped in the deep end. You know, it wasn't like I took baby steps, you know, I dove right in. So,
yeah. So you mentioned a charity. So tell me what it is that you're doing now using your experience to help others.
After Colin died, we had an entire community, as I said, a great, you know, hometown that fundraised and they helped us. Colin worked down at the Board of Trade. So when he was done, there was no vacation pay. There was no, we had nothing. And it was the four kids and I was a stay-at-home mom. So before he died, I said to him, like, something good has to come out of this. Like, I don't know what it is, but this has got to be meaning. Some meaning has to come out of it. So, but then I shelved that and I did what I did. So when I went through the second situation again, you know, being in a situation as a woman, you become like not just like caregiver alone, but like all of a sudden you're, you know, in charge of finances, you're in charge, everything falls on you as a woman. And, you know, even just going to a lawyer, you have to give them like $2,500, like before you even talk to anybody. So our charity is founded on the belief that we want to handle every situation that I've been in, whether that's special needs mom who hits crisis and can't get a vaccine or nursing care. There are all these organizations out there. So when I was like, oh, we'll provide mortgage, people are like, oh, so-and-so does that. Well, we need, you know, utility bills. And the problem is that if you go to the government, which everyone does, you have to lose everything in order for them to be like, oh, you're poor now? Great. We, you know, we got you. Uh-huh. But there are other charities, you just can't find them. And when you're in the midst of caregiving or divorcing or whatever it is, you've got so much going on. You don't have time to research things or you don't know what you're eligible for. So our organization is creating databases of like small charities, things that they will take care of, things you're eligible for. So we want to be like a concierge service where if you come to us, you say like, you know, I'm caregiving my husband, then I can say, okay, fill this out. And the reason that I kind of came upon this is my daughter is a sophomore now in college. And when she was filling out applications for scholarships, you know, everyone wants the full ride. Everyone's trying to get a full ride. Well, what she did was she got like $2,000 here, $25, you know, and before she knew it, she had a full ride. So that's how we're approaching charity. If mortgage assistance is available, I want to match those people up. If you'll pay utility bills, let's do that. So I get everyone where they need to be. And then whatever isn't picked up by anyone else, which is usually legal fees, you know, that's where we hope to kind of focus on. We're networking, trying to get companies that will help with remote jobs. And just really, I'm in the thick of trying to figure out exactly what to do. But as of right now, the most that I can provide people is I'm excellent at research, or if you can't find somebody, I'm the person that can find someone, because that's what I'm really good at. And I've been there. Okay. So I can tell you what to do, what not to do. I've made all the mistakes. So I can point you in the right direction. So
no, I love this. That sounds so fantastic what you're building, because even though we're in this amazing age of information where we all literally walk around with little computers in our hands 24/7, we're also inundated with information. There's so much out there and it's like it can be so overwhelming. And so you are adding on a personal crisis on top of just day to day, sometimes it can be hard to figure out where you want to order dinner from, let alone, you know, helping someone pay your bills or find medical assistance or whatever. This is wonderful.
Yeah. And like I said, you know, everyone's looking for the big save. And I don't think there is the big save. But, you know, if I can take your mortgage away for 3 months on one end and I can pay your utility bills through someone else, like any little burden we can take off of someone allows you breathing room, you know, because unfortunately, when you hit crisis, obviously your attention has to go to like, I can't lose my house, can't lose my car. That's exactly when your kids need you there, but you can't because you're over here. So we're hoping to take some of this away so that you can focus on like truly what's important in that moment, because you get so robbed of you know, trying to heal with your kids and being there and being present. You know, that's the problem, is you're so distracted by trying to pay the bills and get a job. And so at the very time when your kids just really need some stability is when things are falling apart. So we hope to just take that off of someone's plate and allow them to, instead of falling into poverty, which is what happens, we want to, you know, keep people here so that they don't have to rebuild. You know, it takes the average woman 10 years to rebuild after divorce.
Wow.
You know, the average woman's lifestyle goes down 44%. The average man goes down 10. You know, there's just a huge discrepancy in, you know, females versus males. And, you know, sure, we usually get the house, but with the house comes a mortgage payment that we can't pay on our own.
Yeah.
But you don't know any of these things until you're there. And when you when you're there, you don't have time to have the experience. So, you know, the me that told Colin I would do something kind of feels like, you know, I've been through all of these things for a reason, and it's my duty. Once you get beyond it, figure it out. Like, it's so easy to share that than to let other people have to go through it themselves.
I love that. And one question I did want to ask, after all of this was said and done, how are all of your kids after everything? How are they all doing these days?
They're actually really great. You know, like I said, we were blessed because he was never really around. So nothing, the only thing that really changed, I think, is my mindset, because I was always waiting for him to step up to the plate. And there's nobody sabotaging me. But, you know, they are very kind to one another. I am fortunate to have all of them because they are very close knit. And not saying that there wasn't a lot of healing to be done, because there was, you know. Wow. I had a lot of apologies to make, especially to my sons, you know, for the position that they were put in. And they've given me a lot of grace. You know, they've not held it over my head. In fact, they've been my biggest supporter. So everyone's doing really well. I don't know where he is. I don't know where he lives. I don't care where he lives. He hasn't been in our lives for 3 years. And if he can just stay out of the way, then we'll all be good.
Julie, thank you so much for sharing your story and being so honest and vulnerable. And I mean, I always think, you know, one of the things that I've been so grateful for with this podcast is the number of people that reach out to me after they listen to an episode. And, you know, despite talking about all of these topics that, you know, none of these things are things that people haven't heard of before. But what's most surprising to me is how many times people reach out to me and say something like, oh my gosh, like listening to that woman's story, like I felt like I'm not the only one. And so I feel like if there's just one person that hears your story and is like, oh my God, like it's not just me, or like I wasn't the only one who went through that, then it's all worth it. So thank you so much for being here. Tell people how they can get in touch with you.
So if you go to my website, which is juliebarthauthor.com, my special needs daughter who had cancer and the rough start, she's an artist. So she sells her art and the proceeds go to fund the charity. So if you like any of her art, it's on there too. So I'd love to say that I have this huge team. It's just me. If you need help, please do reach out. I'm the one that's manning everything. So if you email, you're emailing me. And even if I cannot help you directly, I will find somebody who can. Hopefully that's my gift, that I'm able to do enough research to find the wizard, I always say. So
I love that. I love that's a great tagline. Well, thank you again for being here. And everyone, thank you so much for listening. Thanks so much for being here for another episode of The Scarlet Edit. If you haven't already, I would absolutely love a rate and review on your podcast app of choice. It means so much and it really helps move this show along the way and get in front of a larger audience. I hope you enjoyed this episode. If you did, I would love to hear from you. It always makes my day when I get a note from a listener saying what they learned from the episode, why they liked it, or even why they didn't like it. Have a great week, and we will see you next Thursday.